and welcome to Gonservation Conversations, the show that knows no limits to its limits. Today I'm joined by musician and longtime nature lover, Jimmy Goodwin. As comfortable in nature's surroundings as in front of an audience of thousands, I hope to delve deeper into his mind's eye and see just what it is that makes him care so passionately about the natural world. Hello and welcome to you, Jimmy. How are you?
I'm very well, Kerry, thank you, my mate. Yeah, I'm good. It's nice to be here at your lovely home.
Ah, it's great to have you here, and seeing as you're here, I thought it would be good to have a conservation conversation with you, because nature is part of your life, isn't it?
I guess it is, yeah. Yes, without doubt. I mean, it always has been. It took a back seat for a while when you're a sort of young teenager, and then I discovered the drum kit and the old grey whistle test and loads of guitars and things like that, and it kind of, you know, receded for a bit, but then came back as it does, you know, as I got a bit older and I met you again, and that really kick-started it, and we started going on little adventures together. I mean, you're the only guy I kind of bird with, I suppose, really. Obviously, and then we've got the guys that we go away with after a fashion, that me and you and Mark Riley and Tony Husband and Guy Garvey and Pete Clute, Pete Jobson and Mike Wilner and Rich. Yeah, you know, we've had a ball. You know, it's great.
But that's the thing, isn't it? Nature is actually great fun.
Yeah.
And on the whole, it's free.
Yeah, it's not dry and serious and, you know, and chin-strokey. It's really, it gets you out and it gets you meeting people that you'd never, you know, I mean, wow, I mean, to go out birding with the Poet Laureate, you know, Laureate.
You mean Simon Armitage?
Simon Armitage, you know, I mean, like, that's, you know, the new one on me. You know, a lovely guy and just, yeah, and, you know, obviously nature means a lot to him too.
I was a bit shocked. He never wrote a poem about us, though.
Yeah, he didn't, no.
Probably a bit busy, I guess, as a laureate.
I guess so, yeah. But yeah, nice man, lovely guy.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right, it's amazing.
Who you meet?
Yeah.
You've introduced me to loads of crazy people. You took me to Bird Fair and, you know, yeah, and the artists. We met because of the Ghost of Gone Birds thing and the exhibition that you created back in, golly, 2011?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, we'll talk about that in a bit, because you played a major part in that, and we'll get to that. So, but yeah, you're right. I mean, I think so many people, when we first got to know each other, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but at the time, nature was considered uncool.
I don't even think the question had even been asked. I mean, there was some, like, yeah, all of a sudden, like about 2 years after we met, a couple of people did some pieces. I mean, Elba were blowing up. And any story, I guess, about Guy was, like, hot. And this sort of did this sort of tenuous sort of, like, nature, musicians and nature, or, you know, especially pop, considered, what, pop or rock musicians. And, like, you know, someone had got wind that me and Guy used to go on our trips together, whale watching and bird watching. And all of a sudden, Oliver Messiaen is being mentioned. And, yeah, I mean, you know, well, it certainly was just natural to us. We were just having the crack. It wasn't yeah, and, you know, but so what's the point of that?
The point is, yeah, that...
Was it uncool? I don't even think it had even been posited. You know, even... It was just felt... I mean, we just kicked in and we met and literally became fast friends within half an hour, wasn't it? We just, like... Jeff Barrett said, you know, Jeff's like a... He's great at hooking people up.
That's Jeff from Heavenly Records.
Jeff Barrett from Heavenly Records.
And Caught by the River.
Yeah, Caught by the River.
Well, that was the thing, wasn't it? Because I wanted to approach you, and I knew that, of course, Jeff knew you, and we'd met because he was intrigued by the project I was working on, the bird effect at the time.
Yeah.
And I'd got in touch because I wanted to get hold of you because I'd heard that you were interested in nature. And at that time, these were all, inverted commas, well-kept secrets as to who was into nature. Mm. You know, nothing wild. Nothing strange, but who was into nature was, oh, you know what? I've heard that Jimmy Goodwin from Doves, he's into nature. Yeah. Really? You know, it was kind of one of those areas where it was odd to find out that people were. So I wanted to contact you because I was intrigued at that whole idea of people being interested in nature but well known for something else. Mm. And I want to find people who had sort of the same common ground as myself that I could go out with because a lot of the birders that I knew weren't perhaps interested in music. It was just the birds.
Yeah.
And as you know, there is nothing better than going for a long walk and talking through things. To go for a long walk, talk through things and common ground and go and see birds.
Oh, it's great.
It's a fantastic...
It kills many birds with one stone. It does, I mean, yeah. It's literally just going out and just casually observe. You get your eye in and just casually observing what's around you. And you see things that you just wouldn't have... It's like, it's great that people have got into feeding the garden birds again. You know, everyone, even the most casual sort of back garden, you know, it's just nice that people are literally putting food out because they genuinely want to see what birds are attracted to their garden and their table. And it's, you know, it's really, you know, I mean, like you have like National Bird Day, not well, whatever, bird, you know, it's spotting birds in the garden, the RSPB.
Yeah, the Garden Watch.
Yeah, Garden Watch. And it's great, you know, it really has sort of put a lot of people... You just, I mean, imagine it. Yeah, it's cliche. Imagine a world without no bird song. It's just,
it's,
and you know what? And it's, there's a lot of places I live in Cheshire. I've got to admit, you know, maybe people will tell me I'm wrong, but it's pretty crap for birds. All the birds that I grew up seeing, you know, it's like I get a blackcap in my garden in September, October, in early autumn, and it'll just come for a couple of days and then it's gone. I ain't seen a greenfinch for 2.5 years in my garden, honestly. Or a chaffinch. I think I saw a female passing through the other day. It's like, what's going on? You know, and all this rewilding of fields that farmers are allegedly doing, leaving like a 9 metre, you know, edge of the field. It's like it was tokenistic, and it's gone.
Yeah, I mean, there are still we
were yellowhammers, man. I mean, you pointed one out the other day on a walk, hearing its song, and you know, I mean, birdsong weirdly for someone who's such an auditory. I'm not a visual person, really. I'm an auditory guy, or, you know, oral. Bum, bum. Little oral Jimmy. Can I get away with that?
Yeah, you can.
It really saddens me that I don't know what it is about, say, Cheshire, one of the biggest counties in England, and where I live. I know you've got the Wirral and everywhere, which is brilliant for waders and all sorts of migratory birds and marsh areas, but, man, you just don't get that stuff near me. And why isn't the kite... Why is the kite only in Wales and it isn't coming up into the south Cheshire, and this bugs me.
Yeah, well, we've got a lot of kites around here.
Yeah, I caught one on the way in, driving, yeah.
But it is that thing, I think. There are birds out there, but it's the abundance of birds that's not.
Mm.
You know, it's like the dawn chorus. It's not as raucous as it used to be in a lot of places.
Yeah.
Not saying everywhere. There'll be people who will tell us about how magnificent theirs is.
Yeah.
But there is a lack of the quantity of birds. It's interesting what you say about greenfinch. I hadn't seen one for a year, and there's suddenly one come in the garden.
3 years ago, they were. Is there something striking them down? Has there been something? Was there not an illness or something that they were getting, finches, a couple of years back in certain parts of the country? But it's bizarre. I mean, even chaffinches, man. I hear them all the time in the woods near me, which is unusual because I didn't really think of them as a woodland bird, really. But... Yeah, maybe you're right. It's the abundance of them. Because I said 3 years ago, I'd seen 9 or 10 greenfinches on the bird feeders.
Yeah.
And now none.
No, it's strange. But that we all know there are problems for nature. I mean, that's why we're having chats like this, just to entice people into nature if they're not already into it. Hopefully we get people who listen to this who suddenly go, hey, this nature thing sounds quite fun, and go and explore and go and discover it and see that it's free. You know, a walk is for free. Okay, right to roam and all of that, and places you can and can't go, that happens more in this country than anywhere else.
Yeah.
But let me take you back in time. I mean, did you grow up in urban surroundings? Was nature part of your life as a kid?
I had a bit of both. My dad built a house outside of, in between Hamforth and Wilmslow, which is in, I guess, South Cheshire. And he came from a very urban background. You know, my family are all from Ancoats, a very, like, pretty much the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution, straight up. That's it, you know, that's where it happened, around East Manchester. So my dad, and his, I don't know who was the first, I think it was our Mick, my Uncle Mick, he bought a farm out in the peat bogs where they found Peat Bog Pete, the you know, Celtic. You know, I think he was sacrificed when he had a thong around his neck, had leather. I mean, you know, that was literally the peat box at the back of Wilmslow on Newgate Lane, which I think was an ancient hanging site. It's beautiful around there, it really is. So I think my Uncle Mick was the first person. I don't know why they chose Wilmslow, because it was a proper... I mean, these days, if anyone's got Arthur, they assume Wilmslow's just like footballer territory, Wilmslow Presbury, and it's become quite affluent. Yet it's sort of like many places, it's got loads of overspills. All my mates were off the estate, you know, it was a Manchester overspill place. Anyway, but I actually grew up outside of... It was a very small farming community when I was a kid, in 1971, 72, when my dad built his our drum. So, right. So I grew up about 4 miles out of town, but I also spent... So I had access to nature, and I was always going down the Bolin Valley. The Bolin's a very big river that runs through most of Cheshire, the River Bolin. It's beautiful. And I did most of my early birding down there and early wanderings. But I also had... The urban, because every weekend I was carted off to my nana's. Not carted off, because I loved it. And my nana had moved from up the road toward Ashton-under-Lyne, up the Ashton New Road, up to Droylsden in Tameside, not far from central Manchester, really. So I had that. So every weekend I'd have a satellite town of Manchester, pretty working class, and then the leafy... So, yeah, I had a bit of both. I'm glad I had both. But then again, there's loads of urban. Like, there was a Courtauld's factory right up behind my nana's house, and an abandoned factory. And in there, you'd see nature taking over. It was a massive site. And we used to go in there and, you know, play footy and smash those tube strip lighting, you know, because they'd make a massive noise in the... It was just, yeah, it was a kid's paradise. It's like proper street urchin gear, and it was great fun. And then you'd have little moss and nature. You know, there's always a wood somewhere, and there's canals, and you know, there's always. I like that as well. I love canal. You know, seeing old factories and rewilding, and just you know, it's yeah. There's always a pocket, isn't there? Even in the most unlikely area, you can always see something.
I think it's all about noticing these things, because I think. A lot of people walk past things without stopping to look. And that's always been a great bit of advice for me, is every now and then, just stop and look and see where you are.
Yeah.
Because most of the time we're travelling like a train.
I had a thought the other day that's in it. I've got a real tendency, or used to have, of just looking down when you walk. You have to check yourself and go, you haven't looked up in ages. You know, all you're seeing is people's knees and feet. You know, it's amazing how you have not bumped into anything, but you just have a navigational thing, don't you, in cities where you don't. And if you're not even staring, these days it's your phone, isn't it? You know, I mean, what do we do at bus stops without a phone?
You know, get really bored.
Yeah.
Go, it's
you
late.
Did. You'd be constantly looking up the street both ways for, like, if you saw the bus going up, well, that means your bus is on its way. It's like, you know, and people didn't even read at bus stops, really, I don't recall. You just used to sit there and daydream.
Yeah.
Anyway, but looking up. And it's amazing how when you get your eye in, like our pal Jim, who we've not seen for a while, Jim from Bird Life.
Jim Lawrence.
Yeah.
Bird Life International.
Man, going out with him, you really do. The more you do it, it's like anything, the more you do it, you get better at it, and you get your eye in. And before you know it, you're spotting, and you're hearing, and you can, you know, it's like they come to you. Once you're sort of aware that they exist, and it's there, then it's all for the seeing. And I love that.
And there was that time with Jim up in Norfolk.
Oh man, that guy is, and he was barreling down these country lanes in the height of summer, and he just literally screeched to a halt and go, golden pheasant, quail, and that guy's like, whoa, this guy knows his onions, man. And it was just brilliant to be around someone that passionate. Really was. It's inspiring. And then you took me to Spurn, and that is just wild.
Yeah, I mean,
was it a Rad's Warbler? We saw a Russian number.
Yeah, there was a Rad's Warbler. Oh, there was all sorts of things. And do you remember that morning? Because we went up. This was one of our adventures with Mark Riley and everyone. We went up and we were told that a friend of ours had booked us beds for the night at the Bird Observatory.
Yeah, which is where the ringers all live and stuff. And
yeah. And it was only £5 a night.
Yeah.
And even at £5, we all thought it was a bit expensive for what you got. And do you remember where you slept?
I slept in my boot. I've got form for snoring, I'm told. But
it's absolutely true, you do.
It was a proper snore fest, that, wasn't it, man? And I ended up in my car, sleeping in the boot. But that was an adventure in itself. And then, you know, you're getting up cricky, and we started early that day, didn't we?
Yeah, well, I think we were out about half five.
Because that's when you're going to get the good stuff.
And do you remember that
I saw shrikes. I love shrikes, and I'd never seen them. I saw grey shrikes or...
Yeah, and I think there was a redback shrike
We saw a redback. I was buzzing.
And do you remember...
The bird. Wow.
Exactly. And you can see it, because with the little mask across their eyes.
The Batman and Robin mask. Beautiful. Yeah.
And do you remember how you had to be really careful where you walked?
Yeah.
Because there'd been a fall of... I just remember walking through this field.
I missed that. You know, I was gutted. I want to go back to Spurn, because you were there a day earlier than me, and you kept telling me, Jimmy, you got to get your ass down here quick. And I was like, I couldn't make it until the day after. But you were there literally tiptoeing among 30 robins and thrushes and all sorts.
Gold crests.
Flocks of them. Wow.
You know, 50, 60, 70 at a time.
Well, all exhausted and almost like...
Yeah, just going, I don't care.
Yeah.
You do what you want, mate. Yeah. You know, when normally all these birds would be away from you.
Yeah.
And it's the only time I've seen robins in close proximity to each other, because there had been a fall of them and they were just exhausted after migrating through the night.
Yeah,
I remember I kept saying to everyone,
from Scandi.
Yeah,
yeah.
And I remember saying, "Oh, I really want to see a brambling," and everyone kept saying, "You'll see a brambling." I was going, "Are you sure?" And then suddenly, I'm surrounded about 200 of them in
that's
a field.
A real migratory bird, isn't it?
Yeah,
in England anyway, the brambling are beautiful.
Yeah,
but lovely.
It was an amazing journey. But, I mean, that's the thing. I kind of remember places now more for the birds I've seen than the place itself, in a weird way.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that will always be the Rad's Warbler as we're all heading off.
Yeah.
And
where were we going one day? Was it driving down to meet Jim in Norfolk? And we actually happened upon, you got wind. It's the only active one I've seen where we've actually deviated from our course to go and see a bird, and I can't remember what county we were in.
We were up in Northumberland. We're on the way to see Pete Jobson and the rest of the gang, yeah.
And you who texted you or something and said, where are you? Because I know you're on your way somewhere, but check this out. There's a...
was it? It was something like... it was a sandpiper of some sort.
It was. And we deviated about 30 miles off course.
Yeah.
And seeing all these proper, you know, paged up bird... What proper, you know... Are they twitchers?
They are. A twitcher is somebody who travels specifically see a rare bird.
Yeah, that's right.
So that day, you and I were twitchers.
That's right, yeah. We actively went out of our way.
But you see, I always think those birds that attract these huge crowds, they're kind of like rock stars. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, you've said that, yeah.
They're in town and everyone goes, oh my God, they're there. I can go and see them. And there's that kind of thing. But there's also that thing whereby after their time has been and everyone's seen it, they're forgotten about.
I know, the sad thing.
And not even a tribute band.
Well, nearly done. It saddens me, actually, when you realise that, I mean, to see a Rad's Warbler in Hull, outside of Hull, I mean, sadly, that little bird's going to be on his lonesome, and it's going to die, and because it's got no, it shouldn't be there. It's been blown off course, you know, way too far east. It should have been in Siberia. Well, no, it was leaving Siberia. Where would it have been going ideally, and then got blown off? Because it was leaving Siberia, because their winter's a double arch, right? It's summer there. I wonder where it would have been technically going.
I don't know.
Probably even Scandinavia's warmer to them than
the... Yeah, I would have thought Central Europe.
And
around and southern Europe.
Blown off by the northern seas, winds and everything. It's just quite sobering that, you know, everyone was huddled around, 40, 50 people getting photos of this little Rad's Warbler. And they even caught it. It was in a ring in that, wasn't it? And this one of the wardens had it, this little dinky warbler in its hand, and we got up close to it, and then they let it go back into the bush. And then I had that thought, and we were talking about it. That's sadly not gonna survive.
No.
And that made me a little bit. It made me feel a bit uncomfortable about this whole. Everyone was like, you could hear a pin drop, and all you could hear was the clicking of cameras.
Yeah, it's a reverence, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's kind of.
But it's quick forgotten. It's soon forgotten for some people, I think.
Well, yeah, once it's ticked.
Yeah.
It's on the list.
It's on the list. They've done it.
We can go.
I mean, I'm putting words in people's mouths. Maybe they really do. I think maybe hopefully there's more to it than just getting on your list,
I think for some
people
are
pretty fanatical, aren't they? I mean, that's all they want is a tick.
Yeah.
It's to say, they took it that far that the buzz only lasts. It's like a drug. It only lasts and then you need more.
Yeah.
Where's
my next rarity coming from?
Yeah.
You
tell me about some of the guys at the top end, that really, really, really are. The sort of competitiveness of it. I find it's hilarious. There's a brilliant documentary, I can't remember what it was called, even about that couple who took their young daughter out.
Well, she's now made her way. She does an awful lot of work about multiculturalism in birding and things now and things. So, it's interesting where you go, but that was an odd documentary. I'm not sure it set them in the best light.
No, it did not.
It was looking for the cheap joke.
I think it was. It just kind of let them rip, throwing a couple of snippets and a banger and let them go and just observe it,
Yeah.
I think they definitely kind of wanted that side. Yeah, maybe amplified that side of it.
Yeah, I think that's true, it's all in the editing.
It was fascinating, nonetheless, that people will take it to that nth degree,
No, it's true. I mean, that's what happens, because it is... When I first saw it, I thought it was a ridiculous pastime. Mm-hmm. I thought, this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And it's only once you suddenly start looking at these birds and understanding them a little, you just get drawn into their world. There's something about them because they really don't care about you. No matter what you do, they're not going to go, oh, there's that nice guy.
Yeah.
There's that guy who came to see me. There's that guy who fed me. It's like... They're getting on with life.
Yeah.
We have no relevance to them.
Yeah. And we don't even know what, half the time, what they do and actually, what their actual daily routine is. Or there's loads of lives. We don't know where they migrate to or how they get there. There's loads of holes in our knowledge still, isn't there?
Yeah. No, exactly.
How are you going to know everything about a thing that can fly? And is mostly unseen by the human eye, their nature and what they get up to. And how it's amazing. Migration just blows my head off. Just to think about it. If you don't even know, when someone told me swallows go back to the place they're born and even use the same, do they use the same nests or will they repair the nests? Am I stretching it a bit there? Am I putting words into swallows' mouth, ideas into... But they certainly come back to the farm and maybe even the rafter that they were born on under.
Yeah.
And that just blows my head off. They're in Africa and they can come 2,500 miles to the same location and breed the next generation. Honestly, that is just incredible and so beautiful. It's like, wow.
Yeah, but birds are incredible. But going back in time, didn't you know somebody who kept injured birds?
I did. I was dead fortunate that my pal Eddie, my dad's mate, Eddie Hindle, a Salford born and bred, his friend Miles Baddeley. I think Miles, he used to have a hippie shot, he was a real dude, a real 6 foot, black-eyed, handsome, he was a real player back in the day, I believe. Miles, but he had a shop in Stockport called 7 Miles Out. And it was just up the hill from the hat factory on the bridge on the A. It's the A6, isn't it? The London Road through Stockport Centre. And he had a bric-a-brac shop, funky. It was like Bieber of Manchester, I guess. It sold furniture, it sold head clothes. He might have sold caftans and all that. I mean, this is before my time. And Miles got out of the rat race, I guess. And he moved to Powys, Herefordshire. he moved to Wapley, a place called Wapley Hill. And Eddie was an old friend of Miles's, and Eddie kind of got the nature bug off Miles. Miles moved to a gamekeeper. Well, before he moved to a gamekeeper's cottage, he moved up Wapley Hill in a cottage and started building nest boxes. And his main passion was bringing back the pied flycatcher to places that it had been, but was somehow something declining. But and he built bird boxes, and he was known as like the Birdman of Wapley Hill. And he'd anyway, that's where I met you, wasn't it? When you said you were doing the bird effects and you wanted to sort of, you were meeting loads of different people who maybe had an unlikely connection with nature. And I said, why don't we meet? I haven't been for years to see my pal Miles. I hadn't been since I was about 14 or 15 the last time I saw Miles, bless him. And then music took full steam, and you know it was like in life, and we just lost touch. Because if he wasn't in England, Miles was in everywhere. Where didn't he go? The Philippines, Bali, Indonesia, you know, and he'd lived there for half the year, and then he'd come back to a cottage with no electricity, just a range and a fire and car batteries for the occasional time he'd put the TV on, the black and white telly. And he had Freddy the Owl, who'd sit in the, it was one of them deep, you know, cottages with like 4 foot thick stone walls. Oh, it was, as a kid, when I first went at like 9, he had an aviary attached to the house that he'd built, and he had injured buzzards, he had injured owls, tawny owls. And I was like, oh, this is incredible. I like this. And just before I met him, he used to have a mountain lion called Khan that used to sleep on his bed. I don't know where he got Khan from, but it was just before I met him. A farmer shot it. It somehow got out one day and was like, naturally, well, what are you going to do when a cougar is in your field harrying your sheep? I mean, sadly, the guy shot it, apparently. But I don't know if it was responsible. It was the 70s. I don't know if it's, you know, responsible to have to own a mountain lion or in captivity. I don't think it's that cool these days. But, I mean, he was a legend, you know. I'd started drawing birds. I think I had the classic little observer book of birds. My mum and dad noticed that when I got into things as a kid, I got into them hard. Like, you know, and I don't know where the fascination with birds came. I just did. Then I got Kes for my 9th birthday. I got a small set of binoculars. I can remember that morning, my 9th birthday, 28th of May, and I was like, my mum was still in bed, it was the summer holidays, or no, it wasn't, maybe it was half term. I just went out down the Bollin and trying out my bins for the first time. I was like, this is ace. You know, because, I was either wrapping me up, like I was either in a throng full of kids, or I really liked my own company as well. I could just switch off me and just daydream and just go off on my own. So Eddie picked up that I was into nature. That's why he took me to see Miles. You know, I think, yeah, Jimmy's showing a real interest here, so I'm going to blow his mind and take him to the Birdman of Wapley Hill. Anyway, I came home and it was obvious that I was, you know, I'd maybe started mothering my dad for maybe I could keep injured birds. Eddie then took me to, I was always in the library. I remember reading things like Jane Goodall and Gorillas, and you know, Gorillas in the Mist, and all those books about anthropology and chimps and behaviour, and I just loved all that. And then I read ornithology books. Is it Eric Hoskins, who had his eye took out by an owl? I thought that was cool. You know, an expert in bird song. I actually got introduced to him by Miles, and he was in his 80s then. Fascinating guy. And then I read a book. I saw this book in the like Wilmslow Library called Kestrels in the Kitchen. And it's about this couple in Longsight, which is a pretty working class area of South Manchester, Longsight and Levenshulme. And they lived in a terraced house, two up, two down. And I saw this book, Kestrels in the Kitchen, and I read it. And then weirdly enough, Eddie went, do you want to go and visit them? I've just met them as well. And they took me to the house. And I remember having a cup of tea, and there's a cockatoo. They had 13 cockatoos. They had 11 Siamese cats. As I'm sat there, there's a cockatoo sipping my lukewarm tea with me on the couch. The front room smelt of ammonia, stunk of wee. But, and they, you know, the gas was pretty, you know, they weren't exactly, well, I guess it was hard maintaining cleanliness and order in a house where I'm sat there and there's a Siamese cat walks past with a buzzard sat on its back. And there's a little owl on the bookshelf in the corner. And they've got a 40-year-old talking crow in the aviary outside that they've had for 40 years called Charlie. I mean, I'd never even seen a minor bird then. And to see a crow that I'd seen, a carrion crow that I'd seen, you know, down the fields. And it was like, say hello, Charlie. Hello, hello. And it's like, what? And they haven't even got a voice box, have they? How do they do it? Crow COVIDs. They can mimic. Magpies can talk or mimic somehow the human voice. That just, I was about 10 or 11. My head was, I was tripping. It was mad. And it was like, this is incredible. And Bob was a taxidermist and also he taught himself veterinary. I think he maybe had to pass, but he was totally self-taught. And that, you know, bird and and I got my first owl, Benita. Some kids had shot its right wing and it had to have half its wing amputated. And I think she was about 4 years old. It's hard to sex them as well, isn't it? I think it was a female, but it's hard to sex owls, I guess. I got my first tawny owl when I was about 11 or 12 and Bob operated on her and I ended up with this owl until she passed away. And at one point in my aviary, I had a young magpie that was just had a sprained wing. I had a herringle with a sprained wing that I managed to put back in the wild and a tawny owl in the same aviary. It's like, so anyway, yeah, 1 week ago, I came back from Miles's and my dad had built me an aviary. It was, you know, really beautiful of him. So I was indulged as well, you know, it was encouraged. You know, Jimmy's getting into this now. Well, you know, he seems serious about it. If I showed that I was serious and it wasn't a flash in the pan, because obviously I had plenty of them, it's like you do as a kid. 1 week I was a mod, next week I was a punk. You know what I mean? Next week I'm in the motorhead. And then things stick, you know, and then it was a proper punk all the way. But yeah, I was, you know, I got to give it, my mum and dad were really encouraging of whatever me and our kid did. They'd back us if we showed it wasn't just a passing phase. You know, it was great.
See, that's what I loved about Herefordshire, because when we first met...
I thought it was a good idea to take you a trip down memory lane to reignite my... to show you where it kind of started for me, or really took, you know...
And what was it like to go back there after all those
beautiful
years?
Beautiful walking up the hill with you, yeah. I mean, yeah, I didn't know he was going to be there, did I? And we knocked on, and it looked like no one had been there, and then I rang Eddie or I rang Rod... I rang Eddie the night before. Do you reckon Miles is about it? He went, me and him have fallen out because he could be a right obstinate sod. I imagine people might hear this that did know Miles, and he was a real piece of work, but a real character. More than a character, that just doesn't do him service. He was a really unique, and he just renounced everything. I think he came from money, but he didn't have a pot to pee in when I knew him. You know, he really was living by his wits. I think he might have even been like, you know, cut off from the family because he didn't quite live up past muster. You know, Baddeley sounds like a quite strong sort of upper middle class name, doesn't it? But Miles Baddeley, very strong. But he was great, man. I loved him. And he'd always have a gorgeous girlfriend that he'd picked up in Indonesia. And it was an American girl, Sue, when I was like 13, 14. And I guess things were changing in my body. And they had a tin bath and seeing sort of Sue, or knowing that Sue was naked in the kitchen and I'm in the front room as a sort of 13, 14-year-old, like, oh, wow, this is weird, you know what I mean? Like, she was beautiful. And it was just dead romantic and, you know, bohemian. And I like that. I've always liked that.
So as we were there wandering around and you were making calls, you discovered that...
Miles was in Indonesia, and sadly Miles... with his Indonesian wife. I hadn't seen him for about 7 or 8 years, and sadly he died in a motorcycle accident. And I've only managed to find one, and apparently he was infamous on the island. I don't even know what island it was, because there's thousands of them, isn't there, in around there in the Indian Ocean. And sadly he died in a motorcycle accident, both of them. And I found one clip online of how he passed, and in fact he even made it to the local Powys paper, and I've got them. I've got like digital copies of it. Yeah, it's tragic, man. But he really was an inspiration to me as a young man.
So after we'd been to Herefordshire and we got to know each other, we started travelling around together and one of the things that I thought was amazing that you did was you wrote some music for The Ghosts Have Gone Birds.
I just forced my way in. to your project, that's what I do. I had this sort of quite Steve Reich-y sort of riff, this repetitive, it's just this really, an earworm to me. and it's cyclical and it just built and built. And I just started making this sort of, I guess, contemporary, going to sound dead pretentious, contemporary sort of classical piece. And it ended up being like 30 minutes long, proper indulgent. No, I hope it's not indulgent. I'm really, really proud of it. I think it's a... And then I got to perform it. Well, again, you never asked me, but I said, I'm going to get a 16-piece orchestra, mini orchestra together here. And you were doing a road test of a slimmed-down version of the Ghost of Gone Birds exhibition, which I loved. That basically, Kerry organised, he got loads and loads of artists, contemporary artists, to depict an extinct bird of their choice, to highlight the plight of extinction, which is sadly still every other day, I guess, we're losing species, aren't we? Or they're in serious danger.
Yeah,
you know,
that's true.
Which is really grim for the world, you know, man. It's not, it's heavy salad, isn't it? It's not good.
No,
it's not. It's not life and matter. It's really, really, you know, to think you're just losing. Yeah, it's not just birds, is it? It's animals and
yeah.
Yeah, it's not right. It's not right. So, you know, yeah, just to get in, to get into it, to get involved. And I just, it was just a lease of life for me. It was something completely, nothing to do with pop music or rock music or...
No, it was great. And it kind of cemented our friendship.
Yeah.
Even though it was already cemented. It,
yeah.
It
no, gave as us... soon as I met you, literally, we both slammed our car doors in a pub car park and we booked in, hadn't we, into this, and we had a great meal. But as soon as I saw your face, we just grinned at each other. Yeah, that was it, mate. I knew I'd met a pal for life. I did. And maybe that's looking back at it, but no, we bonded in an hour.
Yeah, it was
and
easy.
We just had the crack, and that was it. And it was like, you know what? And I hadn't met someone like that for years. You know, that just I just knew we were going to be proper pals.
Yeah.
And no, you got likewise. Some cracking scrapes, man. I really, really, you know. And I've introduced you to some great people, and you've introduced me to some great people.
Oh, it's a totally symbiotic relationship.
Yeah.
You know, that's that's the thing. We do.
And then we realised that we also had loads of people in common, as is the way of things. Like Smithy and that, and, you know, I mean, you always blow my mind with the stories of how you've led a fascinating life, your youth. I mean, I guess I, you know, yeah, like telling you about, you know, Bob and Pat, right? I mean, that's like out of the ordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
To meet people like that.
But don't you think?
At an early age.
For people from the outside, those things are out of the ordinary. For you, when you're living through it,
no.
It's just your life.
Yeah, it's like bloody hell. But it's when you got when you actively start getting into things, I find doors open, don't they?
Yeah. Yeah, they do. And that's what happened with Ghosts. And when we did the warm-up exercise in Liverpool, and I remember we went to Real World as well later on, didn't we, to rehearse? That actually,
yeah.
That was...
God, yeah, that was for the Lush Festival.
But at Liverpool, when you got on stage with... I mean, let's just encapsulate this. This piece of music you wrote, you played everything yourself.
Yeah,
and
programmed all the strings and clarinets and oboes. And I just went proper. I didn't know anything about where they even sit on the stage or the hierarchy of an orchestra. I just went gungo. And, you know, I was probably doing things that you... I mean, well, it proved quite hard to play for some pretty experienced, accomplished musicians.
Is that because... You're in a world where when you're programming, you can cut anything.
I didn't even, I had to realise that some of the limit. I got my head around the idea that obviously violins only had a limited fretboard, and then violas took over, and the lower you got, then cellos took over, and below that was double basses. So I sort of halfway through, or maybe earlier, I downloaded a sort of chart of where things sit, you know, but I was still pretty naive about what you could do and what you couldn't. And I guess that freed it up even more, really.
But what was it like once...
I wrote this... it in a frenzy.
Yeah.
And I just, I don't know, I was jacked up on caffeine and cigs in my studio at home. Jacked up on coffee and snout, man. And,
doing I just went, something for nature.
Yeah, all for nature, man. I wrote it dead quick, but I really got immersed in it. I loved it, and I was dead... Yeah, I stand by it now. I'm dead. I still think it's got legs and it's good.
Well,
I'd be nice to play it again at some point.
It's a fantastic piece of music. And there was something about it. I think the recording was incredible. And then it became something else again once you got an orchestra, the Bird Effect Orchestra, as we called it.
It was great. I mean, lots of people helped me there from the Royal Northern College of Music in Manchester. And this girl, Kate, she sort of helped me get some young you know, well, really accomplished students, you know, they were up for it. You know, I think that, you know, they like putting their skills to use, you know, and it wasn't college work, it wasn't coursework. It was, do you want to be involved in this? And, you know, I mean, it's only a day's work for them.
It was an immense occasion. The music was great. And then
we ended up doing it in Acne.
We did indeed for the London performance.
Yeah, London performance. That
and
was that, great.
That was such a magical night because we had Will Burns, the poet, was there.
For your pal Phil Daniels.
Yeah.
Did the Gulls of Brixton. Which is amazing, on the ukulele or something.
Yeah.
Which is his take on the Guns of Brixton by The Clash. I thought it was great. He's what a guy. I mean, he's one of my heroes from being a kid, man. I mean, I saw Quadrophenia at 12. I just, man, I was to watch that film at least 50, 60 times back to back.
Yeah.
And he was my hero. Jimmy. It's one of the reasons why I changed my name to Jimmy from Jamie.
Oh, yeah. Well, I
remember signing in to Youth Club one night, and literally overnight I became Jimmy. I went, you know, you had to sign in, throw on 25p, and I went, I'm Jimmy. And it stuck, and that was it. I was about 12.
Amazing. All these tie-ups over years.
Yeah, Hendrix and Phil Daniels, that's why I'm a Jimmy.
Yeah. And that night also we had Simon Emerson and his lot.
Oh, Simon's great. He's a lovely guy.
For those that don't know, the Afro-Celt
sound system.
Imagine Village.
He's a great player.
Walking with Ghosts.
Yeah, he's a really interesting guy and a great musician. He's got, you know, he's been there and back.
Yeah, he has.
He's a lovely, yeah.
And then, of course, he returned the favour by getting us to go down and play at the Lush Festival.
He did.
At possibly the muddiest festival we've ever... That's where we rehearsed at Real World.
Yeah, Peter Gabriel's Real World place. And I got... It was a pretty mammoth. I was stressed out to the eyeballs that weekend. You know, I've got to apologise to the stage manager at Lush. It hounds me actually, because I like to think I'm a pretty nice bloke, but we had a nightmare getting on the site there. And I was sort of in my head, I was responsible for 16 people, which I kind of was, but I maybe took it a bit too serious. And we'd had loads of hell getting all these security guards who clearly weren't talking to each other and gates weren't opening. So by the time I got on the site, I was a nervous wreck. And blessed her, this girl who was the stage manager. She was basically, well, doing her job. She was like, okay, guys, strings over there, strings on that side. And I was like, whoa. And this isn't me, man, normally. I just sort of snapped and was really rudely dismissive of this girl. And it haunts me. And I remember, you know, she was literally straight away shocked.
Yeah.
And I never had time to apologise to her later on, going, look, I was way out of order there. So if you do, honestly, it's not my normal character to be, like, dismissive of people, staff who run festivals and, you know, the crew and that. It's not my gig, man, honestly. So I apologise profusely for being a really rude twat that day.
There you go.
Like I say, it was out of character.
There you go. That's what conservation does. It heals the wounds.
I hope so. If she can forgive me, then I'd be very grateful.
Yeah, and of course, lastly on that, you even got
It was hell. It was like...
It was hell. I mean, honestly, I've never, ever...
I've been to Glastonbury when it was bad.
This was three times worse.
Yeah, it was a nightmare.
It was unbelievable. I mean, do you remember, we were worried that actually the whole stage... was going to slide away.
Yeah, I met Martin Carfee that
That's right.
As well, who's an hero of mine, and all I could say to him was, I can't remember, I said
muddy.
Something really inane and crap, like, to him, and he's like, oh, Jimmy, you dick. You, of all the things you could have said to Martin Carfee, and you just really bland, innocuous. Yeah, I was tongue-tied. He was like, he's a hero. Yeah. Lord Franklin's one of my favourite songs ever.
Yeah,
you know, he's been there, and the guy's a legend, British folk legend.
It was good though, and we ended up spending the evening with all the time.
Getting chiselled in a Holiday Inn bar, a Premier Inn.
It was really glamorous.
Yeah.
And there was no audience there, if you remember either.
No, it was empty.
It was empty because it was just the worst
pool,
weather.
Yeah, Poole's beautiful though, isn't it? Poole in Dorset's a beautiful county. Yeah, it's a shame that it just didn't happen, that festival. Oh. But, you know, they had a go, didn't they? It wasn't their fault, really. No.
And, of course, we should just lastly mention he had a great conductor as well, Joe
Duddle. God, yeah. Joe's great, yeah.
Absolute genius.
Yeah.
All right, look, I guess we're kind of heading out of time here.
We haven't really. The conversation just flowed. You haven't actually asked me many specific questions, have you, really?
Well, it's the best way.
Yeah.
then it's natural.
Yeah.
And now it's not.
Yeah.
But I just want to say, is there anything, any bird experience that you've had or we've had or you've had on your own, whatever, that you would consider magical, that has defied description almost, that as I find with nature at times, when you're in the moment with something, in an incident, in a seeing a particular species, time stops.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you think of that you think, my God?
One that always springs to mind is that trip with you and Jim to Norfolk. This amount of species we saw in 2 days just blew my head off. It was amazing. And to get, we went lamping. We went lamping for nightjars, and that, yeah, I can still see it now, I can smell it. Was it Dursingham Wood we were talking about?
Yeah. Yes.
Anyway, it was, we went like at dusk or later to catch nightjars, hunting really at night, you know.
Not to actually catch.
Not nightjars. To catch them, no, just to observe them. And you know, you kind of flash your torch beam, because they're so quick. And they're ground nesting birds, aren't they? And I'd never seen them. And the noise they make, I wasn't prepared for the electricity chirr.
Yeah.
It's almost like electricity pylons. And oh, it was beautiful.
Yeah, and then you really flash magical. The light.
You flash the light briefly, and you can see them flying. And the way they fly is almost moth like. It's erratic, and it doesn't seem to have any pattern.
And their eyes, do you remember their eyes?
Yeah, you get a glint of their eye.
There was bright orange, and it's almost like some kind of strange devil
spooky,
bird.
I mean, they've got some mad names, haven't they? What, you know, goat sucker? You know, like, I mean, where are the origins of that? I mean, they're kind of a sort of, it's like English equivalent of voodoo, isn't it? It's like they're, there's a mystery and a darkness, well, attributed to them by humans, isn't there? For hundreds of years. You know, like in myth, they suck the blood of cattle and goats. And what's their other name? Have they got another nickname?
Oh, there are loads. Yeah. I can't remember
Maybe
them offhand.
Maybe even regionally they have different names.
Yeah, but a lot of these birds do.
They've become one of my favourite birds. I've got a project on the go. I'm making a hip-hop record with some of my favourite rappers. And I've decided to call it Nightjar.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it, because there's something quite secretive.
Yeah, there is.
Because if you actually...
Furtive and mysterious about them.
If you ever come across them during the day...
Yeah, I'd love to see them on the ground. You just blend in, don't they?
Well, you go, there it is.
Yeah.
Where is it?
Yeah.
It's one of those.
It's like snipe and things like that. They're so camouflaged.
Yeah.
It's amazing even how they do that, isn't it? How in winter or summer, you've got ptarmigan or grouse that can literally just adapt their colour. Snowy owls... You know, you can actually change the pigment or colour of your feathers to adapt to the season. Man, it's just that, you know, there you have it, the mystery, the majesty. It's like, I love it. Yeah, once you start really talking about it, and man, it's really. It's awe-inspiring.
So, okay. So
it's all out there on our doorstep as well.
Really. It is.
It is. Just to be, like you said, you get your eye in and then you can't stop seeing things.
So what's the next thing for you with nature? What do you see yourself doing?
Well, I'm down here to see you, aren't I? Because since COVID, we've not had a chance to hang out for a while. So it's been great to come and stay again and break bread And we're going out tomorrow, aren't we, me and you? Because you've got another Gonservation Conversations project on the go about your local river, the River Welland. And you're going to take me to the Welland and you're going to try and involve me in some capacity in its story. And you've been charting the path of the river and meeting up with all sorts of crazy folk to do with it, or who have a knowledge of the river and who live on the river. And who work the river and manage the river, so I'm down for that. And I'm all, you know, if I can find a way in musically as well, then that's great.
Superb. All right. Well, look, Jimmy, we're kind of out of time. There's about 83 other subjects I'd like to have gone through.
I know,
with you.
Yeah.
But you know, we'll do it another time.
Yeah.
So I would just like to say thank you ever so much. It's been an absolute pleasure having you here on Gonservation Conversations. as a guest.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. Nice
pleasure.
One. Nice one, Kel.
Gonservation Conversations is presented by me, Kerry Levy. Our series editor is Leon Rachinsky-Gorman. Our producer is Jackie Anklin. Our executive producers are Ralph Steadman and Sadie Williams. Our series consultant producer is Gary Hayes. Music by Leon Rachinsky-Gorman, lyrics by me. Find out more about Gonservation and Gonservation Conversations at gonservation.com and on Instagram and Twitter at gonservation. Gonservation Conversations is produced as part of the Highway 61 network, supporting independent producers. For more information and podcasts like this one, visit highway61.media or highway61_podcasts on Instagram and Twitter.